Hi guys, and welcome to another episode of the Meat Medic podcast. Now, in today's episode, I'm doing something a little bit different, something I haven't done before. I'm going to be doing a reaction video of something I saw last night on Thomas DeLauer's channel. Why Dr. Sean Baker, King of Carnivore, added fruit to his diet. Now, it's about half an hour long. I'm not going to cover the entire thing because it's not all relevant, but I thought this was a really interesting video and something that I think we should talk about. So, let's have a look at it. I'm going to skip the ads as best I can.
All right, Dr. Sean Baker, I've called you the King of Carnivore before because essentially you are who I learned about carnivore from. I consider you an OG in the space, but you recently added some fruit into your diet, which might raise some eyebrows. That's a little odd considering your typical approach. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened there?
Yeah, I mean, it was just to see something happen. So there is this concept called the lean mass hyperresponder and lipid energy model that posits that in a low carb state, when you're relatively glycogen depleted, your cholesterol will vary based upon how much energy is available, particularly carbohydrates. So if you're in a very low carbohydrate state, there'll be less fat being trafficked in your blood, and therefore your cholesterol will raise up. And so I've done it.
So yeah, what we're talking about here is this lean mass hyperresponder, which basically suggests, some people we just see this huge rise in LDL cholesterol, huge rise in total cholesterol that I've spoken about before, these 10, 15, 20s, potentially mimicking familial hypercholesterolemia, and that's what Dr. Sean Baker is talking about here. And what he's basically going to go on to say, we'll watch the video anyway, but is that, he wanted to see if this would come down with adding fruit. Let's go back to the video and have a little look.
Did just a couple of experiments around that, and I wanted to see, we just talked off camera, a guy named Nick Norwich, showing that if he eats a bunch of Oreos, he can lower his cholesterol 70% in like 2 weeks. So I said, well, let me try that with fruit. I don't.
Now, unfortunately, I couldn't really find the actual study or anything that he's referencing there, but Nick Norwood essentially did this trial on himself. I don't think it was actually a proper study where he basically just ate Oreo cookies pretty much for like, I think it was 2 weeks, and his cholesterol just dropped more than what would happen on taking a statin. So, yeah, pretty significant drop actually. Let's go back to the video.
Oreos, because I think Oreos are kind of, I mean, they taste good, but they're not particularly something I want to try. So I added some fruit.
That's right, Oreos are garbage.
I added about 100 grams of fruit in the form mostly of apples for about a week, and I checked my cholesterol and no difference.
What we don't know there is, does he mean 100 grams of fruit or 100 grams of sugar? Because fruit has about 10% carbohydrates approximately, roughly approximately about 5-6% glucose, about 3% fructose, about maybe 1% sucrose. So I don't know if he's referring to 100 grams of carbs or 100 grams of fruit, because 100 grams of fruit is very, very different. That would be about maybe 10 grams of sugar.
I don't think I'm lean enough, quite honestly. I mean, I think I'm still. I'm just got done for the last several months packing on weight, so I'm still probably, not lean enough to be lean mass hyperfiner. So I'm still relatively energy replete. But I was just playing with that for a week, and I didn't notice, one of the thoughts was, well, maybe I'll get better in the gym. And I'd done this, I was on a ketogenic diet like you 10 years ago, and played with carb cycling and backloading and all that stuff. And I tried that stuff, and I never really noticed like a major training benefit, but it always just kind of, I just didn't, I felt a little bloated. I didn't feel that good. So that's the same thing happened. I mean, first 3 or 4 days, I felt fine. The apples taste good. I mean, sure. But by about.
I think that's an important point. Really, if fruit doesn't agree with you, don't eat it. If you're getting bloated, you're getting symptoms, don't eat it. That's pretty straightforward. And that's certainly one thing that carnivore did teach me. If food makes you feel bad, if food messes with your gut, I mean, don't eat it. It doesn't matter what I say, what Baker says, what Chafee says, what Ken Berry says. If that food makes you have a problem, don't eat it. It's pretty straightforward. What he's talking about there is things like carb cycling, carb refeeding. Now, that's what I'm recommending to patients now when they're doing this long-term ketogenic diet. For me, it's less about, training and in the gym. This is kind of what he's talking about. Baker's a huge guy. He's training very heavily. I'm not enormously muscly. What I'm going on is more health, what I see with my patients. And what I see is carb cycling actually helping with their hormones, helping with their thyroid, helping with other issues that they are having. Let's get back to the video.
Fifth, sixth day, I just started feeling like a little bit of gut irritation, which I just didn't like. And so I said, I'm not going to do it. I checked my cholesterol, and it was, I think my total cholesterol, because I've got a monitor, it goes total. It was about 200 before I started, and it was 200 when I stopped. So I was like, okay, well, it's not doing it for me. However, there's a follow-on to that, because we were talking about this again. I did a little thing where I was fasting for 24 hours after, you know, driving all day. I just didn't eat. Checked my cholesterol. It was 156, so relatively normal for total cholesterol. I fasted for another 13, 14 hours. Did a workout, pretty hard workout, you know, kind of sucked all the glycogen out of my liver, I suppose, and then rechecked my cholesterol. It was 346, and I checked it multiple times to make sure that was right. And, you know, the criticism I was a home meter, but the home meters...
Yeah, look, I mean, that's a criticism, but look, they're pretty accurate. They're not going to be that inaccurate that it's like more than double. And Baker put this on his Instagram, which I saw. What this really shows is that cholesterol is quite variable. It doesn't show that cholesterol is stupid. It doesn't show it's pointless. It doesn't mean we just shouldn't check it. But you have to account for variables like heavy training, you know, the night before, for example. And you don't just take one number in isolation and say, right, that's the problem. And this is what, you know, all the cardiologists do, mainstream doctors do. They just look at your cholesterol and say, right, you need a statin. And they just don't give a crap about anything, any of the other numbers, which are, you know, screaming at them in the face, saying there's loads of problems. They just don't really care about that. They just put you on a statin because, you know, that's what the guidelines say. And I think that's kind of what he's really referencing here. Let's get back to the video.
They're tested to between, you know, 92-95% accurate. So it's clearly there's a shift there. So that's kind of supportive of this whole so-called lipid energy model. So it was just really an experiment for that. But I mean, I think the broader point is, as we were talking off camera, I'm not particularly dogmatic about this diet, even though I'm the guy that kind of coined the carnivore diet. I mean, there are people that were eating all meat clearly before.
I think that's a really important point. And this is something that I've been saying on my channel for a little while now, something I've been saying on social media and attracting criticism for it. That people like Baker, all he ever does is eat meat. It's the only thing he ever meets. He grew this frame eating meat, you know, 60 years. No, he hasn't. He's been eating carbs for most of his life. He's literally admitting in this episode that he eats occasional things other than meat. He's admitted this many, many times in his interviews, in his podcasts. If you just listen to what he says, you know, he says things like, when I just eat meat, I feel the best. That really, by definition, means he doesn't just do that all the time. He's actually eating other things. And this is what I've been trying to say to people. And, you know, you kind of get ostracized in the carnivore community now. They're almost worse than vegans. You know, basically saying, look, even people like Baker, don't just eat carnivore. Don't just eat meat 24/7. You know, life is about eating other things as well. And this is exactly what he's saying. It is not dogma. It is not religion.
But I was a guy that said, let's call it the carnivore diet. And it stuck for whatever reason. But I've been very open about saying, hey, try what works, experiment, see what's going on here. This isn't a religion. It's not reverse veganism where I'm trying to save the tomatoes or something like that. I'm just, you know.
Oh, come on, Baker. Save the tomatoes. Come on. They need saving.
Just like, let's see what works for you and helps you get healthy. So
yeah, we don't really need to save the tomatoes.
It's fun to experiment. And, you know, I've said, you know, I would say 98% on this diet most of the time. Every once in a while, I'll say, you know, I'm going to have something else. And it's, you know, I don't worry too much about it.
And there we go. He's literally said it word for word. He's 98% carnivore, 2%. He just eats what he likes otherwise, and he doesn't worry too much about it. People are often, you know, putting words into people's mouths. These influencers saying, well, they have to be like super hardcore carnivore, and they don't. This is literally him admitting that he doesn't do a hardcore carnivore diet 24/7. And that's again, what I'm advocating for is not doing a strict carnivore 24/7. Let's get back to the video.
What exactly is, coming from a physician standpoint, is a lean mass hyperresponder? Because a lot of people think they know what it is, or it's a very, you know, oh, if you're lean, then your, you know, your cholesterol is going to go up or down depending on, but I want to hear it from your perspective.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
this is a really interesting point, actually. I want to cover this because a lot of people think they're lean mass hyperresponders because they're maybe losing weight or they're not super morbidly obese anymore and their cholesterol is sky high. I see a lot of people using this as an excuse, as a reason for them to have this super high, massively crazy high cholesterol. And probably 90% of those people are not actually lean mass hyperresponders. We also have to remember lean mass hyperresponder, it's not a clinical term. It's essentially a made up term by Nick Feldman, I think it is, who I very greatly respect. I'm not saying he's wrong with this. But it's not a clinically established diagnosis. It's not a well-studied phenomenon. There are studies going into it. But I see a lot of people confusing this, a lot of people misusing this as a means to justify their insanely high cholesterol levels.
A strict definition as coined by a guy named Dave Feldman, who came up with this concept. And basically...
Sorry, Dave Feldman, not Nick Feldman.
It's basically you have a LDL cholesterol above 200. you have a triglyceride that's below 70 and you have an HDL above 80. That's sort of the number cutoff on that. But I mean, concept, and this is usually acquired in a low carb state. So you can, you know, low carb.
And I'm talking about people who are running around with cholesterols of like 900, almost 1,000 milligrams per deciliter in American units. In Australian English units, we're talking about 20, 15, 20, 25 millimoles per liter. Way above this level that Baker's talking about here with Dave Feldman, this lean mass hyperresponder level.
Ketogenic diet, perhaps carnivore diet, that people are going to typically see that. But I mean, I think really what they're getting at is it's someone who is otherwise metabolically healthy by, you know, any metrics, you know, particularly, you know, metabolic syndrome, as we classically describe as low HDL, or sorry, high HDL, low triglycerides, good glycemic control, you know, normal blood pressure, and then the absence of, you know, BMI being high. So that's typically what metabolic syndrome is. So absent all of those.
Yeah, and I see people with all of those problems then claiming they're a lean mass hyperresponder, which again just is not what was coined by Dave Feldman and his team, and they're just using it as an excuse, frankly.
Negative things, you still have high LDL cholesterol, and you know the cutoff they're using is 200. So that is questionably, and I say questionably, potentially protective against high LDL. We don't know for sure. I mean, that's something that I think a lot of people are seeing this data and saying, "Oh, LDL doesn't matter," and I don't think you can say that yet. I think it's.
There we go. Fantastic, Sean Baker. Thank you for saying this. This is exactly what I have been saying, and I'm drawing criticism, understandably, I know, on my channel. This is exactly what I'm saying. Sean Baker has said it here himself. We don't know that these crazy high levels of cholesterol are protective. We just don't know that. There is no data to support that. People need to stop running away with these sound bites and just thinking that they know it all, because they don't. We don't know that these crazy high cholesterol levels are actually beneficial for us.
Bill, I think that sort of hypothesis is generated. I think that we could find that out. And again, the study that Matt Budoff is doing is going to be the first study to sort of really critically look at this, you know, because we just don't have a lot of data. You know, most of the data on heart disease is on people that have heart attacks. You know, I mean, this is who we're looking. We're looking at a sick population in general. So we don't have, you know, an abundance of data on really healthy people, you know.
Very, very true. Yep. All reference ranges are based on sick people because they're based on average population. Average population is sick. So yeah, reference ranges are total garbage.
So that's, you know, this is something that Mortensen out of Denmark showed in 2022. They looked at people that had a very low calcium score, zero calcium score, and they follow them out for, you know, several years and looking at something called MACE, or major adverse cardiac events. These would be strokes, heart attacks, need for cardiac revascularization, or sudden death. And what they found is if your coronary artery calcium
score— death being the most important outcome, of course, which is often ignored in a lot of these studies. Things like the Fourier trial, reanalysis showed PCSK9 inhibitors, I think it was Repatha, actually increased the risk of death. I did an episode the other day looking at this biobank, UK biobank study, showing that lipid cholesterol lowering medications, you know, actually potentially increases the risk of death, which is a pretty serious adverse event.
It was zero. LDL cholesterol had no bearing on any of these events, you know, over a certain period of time. So that's kind of an indicator that there may be some more nuance to this. There's people out there that will say, it's just particle number over time. If you have a high number of atherogenic particles over time, end of story, we're done. No more science discussion is needed. And I think that is somewhat of an unscientific position, because I do think there's, I mean, you know, certainly a lot of it's anecdotal at this point, but I think it's kind of like, you know, there's a guy named Chris Gardner, who you may be familiar with. He's out of Stanford, you know, well-respected nutrition guy, but he said on, I think, Rich Roll's podcast, he says, I think it is unethical to study people on a carnivore diet. And I'm like, well, I mean, you've already got literally tens of thousands of people doing it already. Why not study them? You know, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, we study people on like a vegan diet, which is completely unethical because it's literally not even compatible with human life. I mean, how do you get something through ethics approval when it's literally not even compatible with human existence? And yet that gets through studies, that gets through ethics. So if that's ethical, how the heck is studying a carnivore diet not ethical? Especially as Baker says, like there's tens of thousands of people doing it already. Like, I don't agree with a very strict carnivore diet, but that doesn't mean that I think we shouldn't study it. We absolutely should. But to say it's not ethical, and that's not what Baker's saying here, but to say it's not ethical is absolute garbage. That's just total bullshit, basically.
That's not to study them, in my view, because, you know, you'd like to be able to more definitively say, hey, you are clearly at risk for disease, or perhaps this subset is not. And so that's what I'm trying to get done.
No, I mean, that makes perfect sense. And we have to look at all possible angles here. It's sometimes I liken it to, it's almost like looking at glucose and saying, okay, an athlete is driving their glucose up high all the time.
I mean, it's bad, right?
I want to talk about
the benefits fruit in general, this discussion. Can you see much of a reason for someone that's doing carnivore to ever add fruit in? Is there a practical application if someone has a high training demand? I mean, you train like a beast. We just trained for an hour and I mean, you barely broke a sweat doing some pretty intense stuff. And I know you train a lot. Is there a practical application for someone? I mean, let's talk carnivore versus say animal-based, right? Like animal-based adding possibly some honey in, not focusing on the insulin piece quite so much and being concerned with that.
So he's talking about basically carnivore versus animal-based. Animal-based, of course, is Paul Saladino's diet, where he, you know, typically recommends a relatively high carbohydrate intake. I think Paul Saladino himself eats about 300 grams of carbs a day. Typically, if you go on the animal-based website, animal-based 30, his calculator probably comes out more like 150 grams per day for most people. But I think for me, it comes out about 150 grams, which I still think is a little bit high. On a carb refeed day, it's probably fine. I think for like general population, most of the time, 150 is just still too high. I think I do see huge amounts of benefits in a ketogenic diet. I think this is something that people are getting confused about with me. They're thinking that I'm advocating for a very high carbohydrate diet. I am not advocating for a high carbohydrate diet. Anyway, back to the video.
Take there?
Well, I think that, you know, certainly, I mean, there's a plethora of data that shows carbs can aid performance. I mean, that is undeniable, right? I mean, again, who is the athlete we're testing in? I think people that are chronically adapted to carbohydrates are going to do better with carbohydrates. I think that's just the reality of it. And most people, probably 99% of the people out there that train as athlete are adapted to carbohydrates. Now, I think we're finding out that, you know,
and this might be why some people just really do struggle on keto. I mean, I've spoken about it many times before. My wife, she really struggles on a ketogenic diet. And she's not addicted to, you know, carbs. She's not addicted to sugar. She's not addicted to bad food. She hasn't eaten any like real bad food in like 18 months, but she just can't do keto. It just screws her up. And I see this happening with some people as well.
And there's a guy named Phil Prims who's talked about this quite extensively, that what is driving down the performance in the absence of carbohydrates? Is it glycogen depletion? What is turning out is, you know, like when you see people bonking, like when they're doing a marathon, it's probably more related to blood glucose. And so, you know, once their blood glucose starts to drop, you know, 70, 60, something like that, they start to have diminished performance. And so they talk about a minimum effective dose for carbohydrates. So maybe instead of needing, you know, 60 grams an hour, 80 grams an hour, like a marathon runner might do, they might be able to get away with 10 or 15 grams. And so there may be some utility for, you know, smaller amounts. But again, you have to look at who's the person. If I'm suffering from an autoimmune disease, hypothyroidism, IBD, you know, IBS or something like it, where 20% of Americans suffer from that, then I think you have to look at what is the overall effect. You know, for me, I'm an old guy.
Okay. But what he's talking about there is the overall effect of the food, not of the carbohydrates. Eating glucose will not likely cause IBD, will not likely cause IBS flares, is not likely to cause autoimmune problems. Now, in crazy high levels, yes, glucose is very inflammatory. But in very small levels, no, glucose is not particularly inflammatory. The body can deal with that relatively quickly. What he's really talking about here is the wrapper around the carbohydrates. And that's what I talk to people about. If that carb, if that glucose, that fructose, whatever it is wrapped in Oreos, as he mentioned earlier, in, you know, Twinkies, in breakfast cereals, grains, you know, seeds, high oxalate, high phytate, high lectin foods, yeah, there's going to be a major problem. But if that carbohydrate is wrapped in, you know, very low oxalate, very low lectin, very low phytate foods like honey, for example, like dairy, like milk, like yogurt, it's very unlikely to be a major problem for most people. Some people, of course, are going to be dairy intolerant. It's unlikely to be a major problem for most people to consume 10, 15, 20 grams of sugar. Nobody is going to get problems from consuming 10, 15, maybe 20 grams of sugar a day. Nobody is going to get any issues with that outside of a specific food intolerance. And as I said earlier, if you have a specific food intolerance, don't eat that food. It's pretty straightforward.
You know, I'm almost 60 years old. I've been through the ringer as an athlete. I've abused my body.
I mean, he looks pretty damn good for 60. Got to say.
Not like do drugs or anything like that, but just training hard over the years. And so I have aches and pains when I consume.
So I paused that on the wrong bit there. YouTube, don't ban me. He said he doesn't do drugs.
I just don't feel as good. I feel more inflamed. And so it's counterproductive for me, you know, in an overall package. Like if I don't feel like training, I'm not going to get a very good workout. You know, but if I feel good every day, I'm going to train better and train more frequently with more intensity. But I do think.
Yeah, and that's fair enough. But I would question what carbs he's actually eating. And, you know, can he actually do a low oxalate diet? You know, is he just eating bread and pasta and so on? I mean, I don't know. He's talking about fruit in this episode, but.
You know, carbohydrates, for instance, I think there's pretty good data that shows it helps with appetite. I mean, with consuming more food. This, you know, Stan Efferding, right? He's a vertical diet guy. And he's.
Okay, what he means here is if you want to eat more food, carbohydrates can help. He doesn't mean it helps to suppress your appetite. It doesn't. It increases your appetite. So eating more carbs, if you're trying to get more energy, like if you're seriously working out, seriously bodybuilding, you know, anything like that, yes, you might actually need to start consuming carbohydrates to get more energy in.
Training guys like Brian Shaw and Thor Bjornsson, all these big guys that have this huge, huge eating demand. And so I think it helps us to eat more. You know, I mean, when we talk about muscle building, it's training is by far the number one thing. I think Stu Phillips and other guys have shown this repeatedly. Training is what's going to, you know, you need training to grow. There's no doubt about it. Diet is second fiddle on that side. I mean, diet is still important. Then it's protein and then it's calories. And you know, I find it easier to eat more calories when I consume carbohydrates. I don't know about you, but for me, that's the case. Now I can eat a lot of steak. I mean, I can pack.
So again, he's saying he does occasionally eat carbohydrates.
Way, but it's a struggle. I can do it. And I do that. I think that, you know, as I mentioned, you know, power output better with carbohydrates. I mean, there's, you know, studies on, you know, cycling performance that show that, but again, over a period of 6 months a year. And I think the biggest thing that I found as an athlete, and I've talked to a number of guys, NFL guys, professional fighters, rugby players, soccer players, ultra marathon people, triathletes that have done carnivore successfully. It takes them a while. It may take them 6 months to adapt to that level of training demand before they can truly, I think, thrive on that. But I often tell people if you're going to use carbohydrates, you know, and you're concerned about any negative effects, and a lot of people, there's no negative effects. They do great with that. But if there are, find out what that minimum effective dose is. And it could be fruit. It could be, you know, for me, you know, I don't think carbohydrates are necessarily poison. I don't think glucose is poison. We make it. I mean, we talk about people saying, well, our liver makes cholesterol. How can that be bad? Well, our liver also makes glucose. How could that be bad? Right. I mean,
I think it's a very good point. And it's about the level of glucose. And if you know, your body can deal with it. If you've got type 2 diabetes, type 1 diabetes, look, yeah, you need to keep those sugars low. But if we've got metabolic health, we don't need to fear sugar that much. What he's kind of really referring to here is this kind of explosive energy of carbohydrates versus this kind of long maintaining energy of ketosis or ketones, akin to, you know, like a short distance sprinter versus a long distance runner, for example, marathon runner.
Obviously, at super high levels, it's a problem, but you need it for brain function, adrenal function, testicle function, red blood cell function, all the things that are primarily dependent upon glucose. And so finding out how to sort of
And these are the things that I've seen people having problems with on this long-term zero-carb diet, this long-term strict carnivore diet. What Dr. Sean Baker is saying here, I just want to go back a little bit and just get him to repeat those things again.
You need it for brain function, adrenal function, testicle function, red blood cell function, all the things that are primarily dependent upon glucose. And so finding out how to sort of optimize your glucose utilization with, you know, minimal dose. Like for me, if I consume carbohydrates right now, my blood glucose will shoot through the roof. Yeah. If I consume 100 grams of carbs, like, you know, simple sugars, my blood glucose might hit 300. I mean, because I'm not adapted to that, right? I mean, if I adapted to that over a period of a couple months, it would have a normal response. But yeah, I think that those things can be helpful. But again, it's like I mentioned before, I'm a physician. I'm not really here to talk about, you know, optimal athletic performance. My concern is I get somebody with autoimmune disease, food addiction, diabetes, obesity. That's my primary focus. Now, if you want to do it as an athlete.
Which carnivore is great for all of those things. It's just not great in the long term for a lot of people. And just a slight tweaks can make a big, big difference.
Find benefit, particularly as an older athlete. You know, like I said, you're 35, I'm 57. There's differences between us. I mean, it's just a matter of the mileage. And I think you'll find that you may have a different perspective when you're older. Because I see a lot of guys in their 20s.
And kind of makes you feel a bit bad, really, when there's a 35-year-old and a 60-year-old. That looks so much better than you do at 39. But anyway, never mind. We're not here for me. We're here for Dr. Baker today.
Like when I was in my 20s, I was out partying and drinking and eating garbage, and I still no problem, you know. And it was just like,
oh yes, we can all attest to that.
35, 40, 42, and then I started to say, okay, I can't do this stuff anymore.
Is that when you kind of noticed, okay, I need to change something with my diet?
Well, I mean, I think in retrospect.
All right, I'm going to skip a little bit now because this is already getting a little bit long. Let's go to combining fats and carbs.
Maybe it's inaccurate that like if I'm eating carbs and fats together, it just doesn't seem right to me. It seems almost, if I had to put it from like a biological, like evolutionary sense, it doesn't seem that realistic that we would have a surplus of fat and a surplus of carbs at one sitting, right? Maybe there'd be a time where we get some berries. Maybe there'd be a time where we get a big kill, right? So
that's true. I mean, in nature, carbs and fat pretty much almost just do not come together. And I don't know if we're going to talk about the Randall cycle. We'll have a little listen. But the Randall cycle is something that people get so confused. They throw it around. And honestly, it makes little to no difference, believe me.
Always just seemed odd to me. So a lot of times if I'm in a block where I'm a higher carbohydrate, I'll decrease my fat intake. And then I end up finding I'm eating like 1800 calories. So I end up just bonking, right? So for me, when I go keto, I end up having this, I grant myself this amnesty to like have more fat and more calories. And next thing I know, I'm at 3,500 and I'm actually recovering better. And I'm simply because I'm in a better state of energy balance. But that's.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't really matter whether you're doing keto or high carb. If you're under eating, you're under eating at the end of the day. You're not going to recover properly, especially at the level of training that these guys are doing. You need those calories.
My story. I want to circle back to the Randall cycle for a second. What's your take on that? I mean, I know Charles Poliquin even used to talk about it years and years ago. Do you think there's merit to it? Because there's.
Sorry, I'm kind of excited. I want to hear what they say about the Randall cycle. I haven't actually really watched most of this video before. This is a genuine
literature, but it's a little dodgy.
Well, I think if we just look at the obesity epidemics, it's probably the combination of fat and carbs, donuts and ice cream and all that stuff, which is driving a lot of just the fat stores. And so I do think if you're primarily adapted to fat and you add carbs into that, you're going to have energy issues. I mean, you're going to have too much energy in your blood in the form of high blood glucose. And consequently, if you're eating a lot of carbs and you consume a lot of fat in there, then you're going to have issues with too much lipid in the blood. I think it's better to be either or at least primarily one or the other. Like I said, if you're going to go low carb or zero carb, you need fat. I mean, you clearly are going to need fat or you're not going to do well. And then the same thing, if you're going to go very low fat, then you're going to need that carbohydrate. You know, the interesting thing is, you know, we have essential fats, we have essential protein, amino acids. We don't really have essential carbohydrates, albeit they clearly provide energy and they can be useful. But I think.
And that's what I say to my patients, you know, just because there's no essential carbohydrates, which means we don't need them for life, doesn't mean that there's no benefits in carbohydrates.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people who talk about the Randall cycle, and it exists. It's a real thing. And I do think that, we often preferentially do, like you said, you're in no man's land. Now obviously.
If you're not sure what the Randall cycle is, I mean, basically it's, the body can, or the mitochondria, the power plants of the cells to produce ATP, adenosine triphosphate, which is the energy cell, so to speak, the unit of energy that the body uses. Basically, it can burn either glucose, it's a very complex pathway, but to simplify, it's either glucose or it's fat or fatty acids, really glucose or fat that comes down these pathways, enters through the CPT1 gene, which I'm going to do another episode on soon, and then basically competes essentially in the mitochondria. That's the easiest way of thinking about it, to produce energy. And effectively, if you're adapted to eating one, say you're very adapted to eating glucose, you're probably not really going to burn fat very well. If you're adapted to burning fat, you're probably not going to eat glucose very well. So this leads people to say, well, you shouldn't eat fat and glucose at the same time. No, that's not what this is about. It doesn't really make any difference whether you eat them at the same time or not. It's just having them in your body at the same time. If you're adapted to kind of eating both, you're metabolically flexible, it doesn't really matter at all whether you eat a little bit of carbs and a little bit of fat. It really doesn't make any difference. Your body's just going to burn through all of it anyway. So it's not something that like probably 99.9% of people actually have to have any concern around.
What you're doing, you know, building muscle. I mean, I just, you know, I'm the same way. I like to be strong. I like to be functionally fit. I like to be doing those things. This question is that a normal human being? And I think that probably not, quite honestly. There weren't, you know, if you go back, any, if you look at.
So I'm just going to skip a little bit now.
You know, even in my book, The Carnivore Diet, I specifically say humans are omnivores. I mean, I specifically said that. I think there's also this concept of a facultative carnivore where we sort of do really well on a mostly meat diet. But I mean, I mean.
Mostly meat. Not entirely.
I mean, if they had Twinkies growing on the trees 50,000 years ago, we would have eaten them clearly because they taste good, right? I mean, we ate whatever was available to us.
Exactly. We ate what was available.
We're seeking out energy. We weren't seeking out vitamin C or vitamin D or magnesium. We didn't know about that stuff. I mean, no one had a concept of that. We just ate what intuitively tasted good to us. And I think it was, you know, obviously animal fat. I mean, I don't know about you, but I find a fatty steak to be very, very viscerally satisfying. There's no doubt.
But nutrition is often what satisfies hunger, not just fat. Fat is very satiating, as is protein, but nutrition is more satiating. And what tastes really good is actually proper nutrition, not just fat.
That's for sure. Hardwired to us. Yeah. And I also think, you know, you would have clearly come across fruit. You would have eaten that. I think that's undeniable. Now, again, the question is how readily available was it? You know, it depends on where you were. I know there's people, you know, in the tropics. Yeah, you've got it year round. I mean, but if you'd lived Europe, North America, it's undeniable that the evolutionary past, if you believe in evolution, I know a lot of people don't, was.
This is literally exactly what I say to my patients word for word. A lot of those don't actually believe in evolution. I'm just going to move on.
Mostly ice age times, you know, for the 200,000, 300,000 years that Homo sapiens were supposedly around.
But technically, we're actually still in an ice age, but because ice ages pretty much actually never go away. We're in a warming phase right now, just of note.
That's, you know, how much you had access to it is debatable.
So I think that's pretty much all I want to cover with this video, because the rest is just talking about Dr. Baker and his diet. So I wanted to cover this because I saw it and I thought, okay, this is going to be pretty big. You know, Dr. Baker actually talking about adding fruit to his diet. What he's obviously not saying here, he's not going Paul Saladino. He's not going 300-400 grams of sugar. He's not necessarily even eating sugar every single day, like I'm recommending 10-15 grams. No, this is not him saying I'm admitting I'm actually a fruitaholic. And no, this is not what he's saying. He's just saying, look, humans are omnivores. We're designed to eat a range of foods, that we shouldn't just be 100% carnivore necessarily all the time. There are a few little benefits in carbohydrates for the right people at the right time that they can potentially support the body. I think he mentioned things like brain, you know, thymus, thyroid, testicular function. I've mentioned previously, you know, a patient who had total testicular failure when he completely cut out all the carbohydrates. Now that may be perfect coincidence. I don't know. Maybe it's not. So yes, this isn't a green light to just go and eat sugar willy-nilly and eat 500-600-700 grams of sugar like the guidelines, you know, suggest we do. But also I think it's perhaps a wake-up call for some carnivores out there that are becoming extremely dogmatic following this extreme carnivore diet, this ultra, almost ultra-orthodox, you know, zero carbs, zero sugar, zero vegetables, zero fruit. You know, you can't ever deviate from the path, otherwise you get ostracized and excommunicated, you know, virtually. You know, I've been kicked off so many forums for just suggesting people might want to actually just consider having a bit of vegetables or fruit in their diet. It's becoming a joke. It really is. I would encourage everyone to just think about what they're eating, listen to your body, eat intuitively. Like Baker's saying here, eat, you know, like a 98% carnivore diet. That's basically what I eat. You know, for dinner tonight, I'm going to basically have a cheeseburger, you know, ground beef, mozzarella cheese, and maybe a slice of lettuce, you know, with a bit of fried onion on top. It's like 98%, probably more, the calories is like probably 99% actual carnivore. It's just meat. There's just a little tiny bit of extra for things like folate and vitamin C, which are really important. I'll probably have a glass of milk this evening for iodine, which is just not there on a carnivore diet. So just eat intuitively, listen to what your body's telling you, and just don't be dogmatic about the carnivore diet. Thanks, guys. I'll see you in the next episode.